Welcome to TechLash, a celebration and dissection of the tech industry and its impact on the world. Warning, this podcast has been known to raise awareness, provoke thought, and spark debate. The views expressed by the host do not reflect those of the guests, sponsors, or any other competing interests.
There is a major breakthrough heading to America.
Twitter has an iPhone.
Researchers at MIT are hailing a breakthrough in the field of artificial intelligence.
Just how crucial is diversity to the tech world's future?
Facebook will be allowed to settle
the number of users affected by Yahoo's analytics.
Different economic backgrounds, different educational backgrounds.
Welcome to TechLash. I'm Zibi Nwaka, and I'm here with Theo Miller. Theo, who's our guest today?
Today we have RubiconMD, and we have the co-founder and CEO, Gil Addo.
And what does RubiconMD do?
They provide telehealth services. So specialists are located in major hubs in major cities like Boston, and it's very expensive for people, let's say in Indiana or Kentucky, to go have a consultation with one of those doctors. And there's all sorts of associated metrics along with how many referrals you should have if you're a physician. RubiconMD helps with all of that.
So it sounds like they're addressing some of the inefficiencies in the healthcare industry, and their product caters to primary care physicians, as we'll learn.
Yeah, the other thing I would throw in there is access to healthcare is not a small subject. There's many sides to that issue, and it has many implications for race and socioeconomic status. And Gil wrote a blog post this year in response to Floyd that expresses his feelings around the subject, and we get into it in the interview.
Excellent. Really excited to jump into the session today, and without further ado, a word from our sponsor. Diversity has always been an issue in tech, and now it has been compounded with a worldwide pandemic that disproportionately impacts underrepresented groups. This needs to change. FlockJ is a tech sales training academy that helps job seekers from non-traditional backgrounds break into tech. Through 300 plus hours of live instruction, real sales practice, and one-on-one coaching, students master the art and science of tech sales. Top tech companies like Zoom, Gusto, and Airtable partner with FlockJ to hire diverse, elite SDRs that ramp faster and outperform ordinary reps. Visit FlockJ.com to learn more. That's FlockJay.com.
The way it works is really simple. Patients go to see the primary care clinician. If there's something that's outside of their expertise, they would go to our web-based platform, input any relevant information, labs, pictures, x-rays, and just ask a question. It's text-based. We would send it to the right specialist. We have a network that we've curated across 150 plus specialties and subspecialties, and they would provide a response back to the primary care clinician. Text-based, they can use mobile, web, we integrate with electronic medical records, and that response comes back to the clinician who will then use the information to follow up appropriately with the patient. So what we found is half the time, you don't need the patient to ever travel to see the specialist.
So healthcare and going to doctor's offices and dental offices, I don't know how many manual forms I've had to fill out. Some of them have some of these iPads now, and you can enter in your information and slowly starting to modernize. But for the most part, they're all still paper, wet ink based. And I've had to refill my information at all of these different providers. I would love to just be able to almost have an identity in my iPhone that I can just tap when I go into a specific office.
Yeah, I feel that way when I rent apartments. I guess I've apartment hopped a fair amount in the last few years, and there's that whole long, intimidating form of where have you lived? What was the address? What was the number of your previous landlord? It's that kind of a frustration that feels like it should be streamlined in 2020. I also want to say I haven't had the misfortune of having to go to a doctor's office this year, and I know that you've been to a few recently. Do they still have like the paper magazines and everything? Because that just seems like a germ fiesta.
Yes, they do still have the paper magazines. I haven't touched any. I've visited more the dentist's office, as this dental work that I've had to do.
Here's the other thing I want to hit on here. When he's talking about fax machines, he's talking about pagers. We know with our experience getting cut off the ground working with law firms and how much they have to monitor all the specifics of what goes in and out from a data perspective, it forces those organizations to rely on antiquated technology. And it's the same thing with medical. They have some cutting edge equipment, but for the most part, if something can stay antiquated, it does, to mitigate risk.
There's such low-hanging fruit in entrepreneurship in healthcare because there's so many problems. Like, we're the one industry that's keeping fax machines, and I think it's okay to say that fax machines aren't innovative. They're keeping fax machines going. You've got pagers still being used. So there's just such low-hanging fruit in terms of the opportunity to solve problems because there's so many people that want to do good, but it's so slow to opt those things that can benefit.
So this plays into that idea of short-termism and having immediate profits and hammering and driving that home versus focusing on a long game and solving and actually helping human beings and helping people and actually solving the hard problem. But that takes a lot of money, energy, and time. It's probably too late for the Facebooks and the Twitters of the world who are beholden to shareholders. And so every analysis is, will this make more money when I A, B, and test this versus will this hurt society if I roll this feature out?
Yeah, if you look at the last 10 years that we talk about a lot in the show, what you'll see is the rise of digital products as the lifeblood of Silicon Valley. And because a digital product can be iterated on in perpetuity by pushing a line of code, that has made the standards for quality much more relaxed. But when we talk about the Elon Musks of the world, or we talk about the Elizabeth Holmes of the world, and we talk about the consequences of these much more serious businesses, they have to be held to a higher standard.
So the problem at the highest level is that most of the specialist expertise in this country is co-located around a few hubs. And I was able to pretty acutely see this challenge. So growing up, I had a grandmother who was based in Barbados. She developed a brain tumor, traveled to Boston for surgery. Makes sense. There's a lot of specialists in Boston. And then spent 5 years going back and forth on all the management of the tumor. So part of the opportunity and the challenge is how do you take the expertise that sits in places like Boston and its incredible academic medical centers and teaching hospitals and get it out to communities across the country and frankly the world where it can be helpful.
So I used to be on an HMO plan where I had to do everything through this primary care physician. And then I've since moved to PPO where I can go and get direct access to these specialists. So I don't have to go through the gatekeeper necessarily of my primary care. Now, they still ask me who my primary care is. But when I was in HMO, I've been referred to the wrong doctor. And it's like, oh, no, you have this problem. You actually need a dermatologist, not what I'm doing. And so the referral process, it's hard even doing it on my own now in the PPO, but even the HMO, I think for primary cares, they're just trying to get you in and out. They got appointments all day, right? Like, it's like, let me stamp this and get you to this person. And so it's this misaligned incentives world, just trying to jam as many bodies through their process and system. And it's god awful.
The same underlying trend that has made us more dependent on Zoom in the last year is relevant here. And I say more dependent on, but in reality, it's liberating us from having to go places that are unsafe, that are far away. And when it comes to medicine, yeah, I would much prefer not to have to wait in a doctor's office with those germ fiestas. I'd much rather sit in the comfort of my own apartment and be like, okay, well, I'm going to jump on this call with this doctor who's going to tell me what I need to know because they have expertise that's unavailable in my tri-state region. That just seems like an obvious thing that should happen as we become increasingly distributed in the 21st century.
On top of that, I don't want to go to a specialist
and have to re-enter my whole form and my whole history all over again.
Even if it's life and death, though, it's a small price to pay if you need to like get a lung removed. I feel like a little paperwork is not necessarily a deal breaker for me.
Shouldn't I get under the knife immediately, though, if I need a lung removed versus filling out paperwork? Couldn't that be a potential cause of my death, is having me sit in the office, especially with COVID? I don't want to be stationary in an enclosed space for longer than I have to.
That's the big thing with COVID. That's the most terrifying part of it, is that if you actually get sick for something unrelated or you get hurt, the likelihood that you'll be exposed to it is much greater.
One of the things about the ACA, very partisan in different pieces of it, but one of the things that's very bipartisan and has support from both sides of the aisle is this shift to value-based care. So the idea that rather than charge people for everything that happens in the healthcare system, that you pay the healthcare system to be able to provide better care, and you just pay them what you think it should cost, and they figure out how to manage the patient within that cost. The best way I explain it is the current system of fee for service would be like if you went to the gym and paid for every piece of equipment that you use. And that's not the way healthcare should work, because you want to incent people to not use additional pieces of equipment. You want to incent them to be healthier, to provide better care.
So there are a few things to unpack. This value-based system that Gil's talking about here, the way I've wrapped my head around it is, right now, the system is volume-based. As I mentioned earlier, it's hurting people through the system. It's just volume. Let me just pump out as many people as I can with no tie to outcomes whatsoever. Another thing that this made me think of is the whole OxyContin problem we've had in the U.S. and pill mills, as they call them, and these misaligned incentives where you want them to be sick. You want them to come to you with pain. You're incented to keep them sick almost. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it's a lot like the private penitentiary system, where the incentives are so misaligned that they're disproportionately locking up people of color to hit quotas, which is a form of systemic racism. It does remind me a lot of the pharma bro. It reminds me of Martin Scorsese, who really is a nice little comical character who came in the last 5 years.
So here I go on my defense case for Martin Scorsese. I think he was just more vocal. I actually think they're sitting CEOs of pharmaceutical companies that are way worse and probably deserve just as much as Scorsese has. Now, to be accurate here, he is in jail for securities fraud. Not necessarily like, oh, I raised prices and I gouged consumers.
In terms of the scope of criminality, Scorsese is a poster child. He looks the part. He does look like Don Jr., right? And so we can just attack him as a human pinata. But do we think that there's some kind of like gluttonous creature stirring in the back, like an arch villain in pharma? And is that the CEO of every major pharma company? I'm not going to say that, but I'm going to put the thought out there. Value-based pricing is really critical in business. It allows you to create leverage if you can express a value proposition that warrants a disproportionately high price in the marketplace relative to the services or the products you provide. So I don't want to hate the player, but the game does suck.
It does. And healthcare is a hot button issue in the US, but I think most people agree there should be a baseline level of service. You shouldn't be completely destitute after getting sick. I think most people on both sides agree. And the focus on healthcare has been a winning issue for politicians who engage in that.
Yeah. On the preventative care front, all year we've been hearing about people who are succumbing to COVID had underlying morbidities. Underlying morbidities define this country. We are nothing without our underlying morbidities. And the idea that we're going to invest in preventative care, one stat on that is they have this value-based contract where a primary care provider can earn an additional $150 if they don't refer them to a specialist. And so I'm assuming Rubicon doesn't count in this regard because it's a virtual consultation, so it's not the same principle. The point is that these physicians with Rubicon in place see a 30% reduction in referrals.
On the note of comorbidity, I was watching a Bee Gees documentary last night on HBO. Fantastic. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But
is this about staying alive?
It is about staying alive. In the 70s, they were shots in New York. Everyone was so much skinnier.
Same thing in the 50s. You see pictures of crowds in the 50s and everyone looks svelte.
It's just like, whoa.
It's the processed food trend line.
That processed food, the Pepsis, the McDonald's. I think about where I grew up. I've been visiting these suburbs in New Jersey. It reminds me of where I grew up. It's like Wendy's on a corner, McDonald's on a corner, totally. Dunkin' Donuts on a corner.
But you're opening up a much bigger point here, which is the food desert phenomenon and the fact that I take it for granted that growing up in a suburb of San Francisco, there were petitions saying, we don't want Starbucks in our downtown. And there's cultural reasons for that, but that does open the floodgates to why not a Jack in the Box? Why not a McDonald's? And while it's kind of gauche to have something like that where I'm from, it's actually a matter of health. It's a matter of socioeconomics. And we touch on these systemic issues. This is how they manifest themselves in real time. It's where that Taco Bell opens up and what is prevented from coming in that could provide longevity for an entire population that's prevented because they have food services that value quantity over quality and ultimately are to the detriment of the general population's health.
I was in the second year of business school. I took a trip to India with some other students and we were looking at healthcare delivery models across India. I mean, there was a really interesting model that we looked at. It was through a nonprofit, but what they were essentially doing was using community centers as hubs. If you needed clinical expertise, they would essentially leverage technology to bring that expertise from whatever teaching hospital in the nearest city into the community center. So that's the idea of making a community center. And obviously our model is different. We're around a community health center or a primary care practice, but the same theory that you make the community and the trusted resource that you go to, the hub for care, was inspiring.
Many other countries are being innovative in ways that the US can't get out of its own way. And again, the incentive system isn't aligned. It's interesting. We want this innovation, but to your point earlier, it's almost like this is being kept stuck in the mud by certain entities within healthcare that don't want efficiency. It reminds me of when I go to other countries and use their infrastructure versus riding the subway in New York. But if you go to Tokyo, the subway system is unbelievable there. And the argument can be, well, it's 50 years younger than the US system, but we've just spent $0 on infrastructure. The effects of infrastructure, politicians aren't going to see the result until they're out of office. So we're focused on this short-termism in the US, and this has really hurt us in many fields, including healthcare.
We have the worst of both worlds in the United States. We broke away from England centuries ago with this swagger that we're this dynamic, adolescent, energetic nation founded on principles that did not exist in the world. And that was really, really innovative at that time. But now we're incapable of iterating on that initial document. And what that does to our country is it keeps us stagnant, but it still has that irrational exuberance of youth. When you put it up against a country like South Korea, which has a newer government, you start to see that we not only are missing out on contemporary best practices, but we have this attitude as though our practices are the best. We have that American excellence to compensate for our lack of performance.
Exactly. And so it is the very reason why we should look to other countries who are coming up with these fresh ideas and can implement them. And so this idea of community center and getting to the community, it creates a larger surface area to deliver healthcare and it creates more trust in the community, right? And this argument can be superimposed or extrapolated to policing too, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of community policing. So this community centers thing is really interesting to me and creating trust within the community that like, hey, we need to distribute these vaccines when they go out. And let's put aside the anti-vaxxers. There is just general mistrust. The average person, if you've been in a marginalized community and you've just been abused and mistreated and there's zero trust. So there's also an element of like, why am I going to take this mm-hmm. when you have oppressed me systemically for
right
my entire life.
There are legit cultural scars in what you're talking about. As we zoom out and we look at the information age, we're really going to see this moment as a complete reaction to sudden access to the fire hose. We went from having a really moderate amount of information in the 20th century, and now we're at this point where we have such an onslaught of information that it's an ink blot. and people can say and do whatever they want because there's enough information out there and they can substantiate whatever claim they want. That's well established. But that larger historical context, I believe if we're to get out of this, there's going to have to be some regulating force. Either these big tech companies are going to have to own up to their journalistic responsibilities and put forward some sort of code of ethics so that they don't distribute false information, or the government's going to have to step in. But the problem is we're in this place where the government can't keep up with the rate of change in technology, and the companies are incentivized to get as much traffic as possible, which again, to your larger point in this conversation, is a misalignment with the public good.
And we are beholden to the companies to quote unquote do the right thing. But luckily, Rubicon is doing the right thing. And so this inspiration of these community centers, we're going to learn how much we're in need of that because we have this problem with localized hotspots. And that can be hurtful again to these marginalized communities.
If the patient and patient's care isn't at the center and the core of what you're doing in healthcare, eventually you're going to fail. It may not happen right away, but eventually you will fail and you won't be sustainable. So we kept that at the core. We had a mission around democratizing medical expertise, but we saw massive spikes as everybody moved virtual. And these are rural communities supporting underinsured and uninsured patients. And so there was a huge need, and we knew we could meet the need. And so we did that. And the benefit for us will be longer term, but the upfront need and meeting that, we will benefit as a business. We're in the right place right now, so we didn't have to worry. But it's how do you benefit in a responsible way where you're also thinking about the ways in which you can meet the need right now?
So my father had throat cancer at 50. And we were very fortunate to be in Dallas at the time. And we had access to the best doctors. He was given 6 months to live. So he survived for 5 years after that. So we were super lucky to be in an area with an abundance of incredible healthcare. But I think about what happens if that diagnosis happens when we were in Indiana. Now, Indianapolis has good healthcare as well, but it's a life or death situation we're talking about here. And so this idea of expanding to these community centers and increasing the surface area and expertise throughout the U.S. is a life or death argument.
It's always interesting to hear how entrepreneurs come to the missions that they embark on with their companies. And it's not surprising to know that Gil had a family member who went through cancer and was unable to access the care as efficiently as he would have liked them to have been able to access the care. And it's never that hard to reverse engineer how someone got to the company that they got to if you just dig into their biography a little bit. And that's one of the more rewarding things in doing these interviews is to learn about people's histories and how they connect to what they're doing today.
You're exactly right, Theo. Life experiences often drive founders to have this relentless focus on solving these issues. And I think the political climate also impacted many founders of color this year. And Gil writes about this in a blog post he put out, and it really informs his business philosophy.
I think everything around the diversity, equity, and inclusion discussion boils down to it's the right thing to do. And if you do the right thing, you'll have a business advantage because you'll recruit better candidates. You'll find opportunities to get talent that other people aren't. You'll build a better team with better ideas that works well together. More people will want to work there, and you'll deliver a better product. And so you'll be a better business at the end of the day.
It can't be said enough. Sadly, it has to just always be repeated that building diverse teams and having diversity in your business is good business. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate that we have to constantly repeat that because it's not only the right thing to do, and it reflects America, but we always have to say, hey, like the data shows that you will be a better company. How about just do the right thing?
So there's data, there's do the right thing. And then there's also just basic arithmetic. If you double the size of the candidate pool, you double your chances of finding a great employee. It doesn't seem much more complex than that. There's other underrepresented groups, but if you just take women, 50% of the population, and you bring them into the hiring process on equal footing, you'll double your chances of finding the candidate who's right for the position. There's all this talent that's being sidelined. It just seems so obvious to me.
And I think it ties nicely in with that concept of increasing surface area and the influence he had from the community centers in India and being able to reach out to these communities with people who look like you. There is an element of that. And again, I said back to the community version of policing as well, too, is this piece where I want someone who I can relate to and build trust with at a certain level. And having a level of diversity at your company can help you do that.
Systemic racism in this country has led to all of these gaps that we're seeing through COVID and all of the things that we now understand in terms of the chronic conditions that are risk factors for COVID. It's led to people who have less access. It's led to people who are in communities of color who are more likely to be frontline workers, all those things that people have heard through COVID. And then when you take the entire system and shift it to virtual and you don't have access to internet, you live in an apartment with three generations living in the same apartment, you're not going to have a great experience with a virtual telemedicine visit.
So this highlights a bigger issue. I'm going to zoom out of healthcare and into internet access. And it was surprising for me to know that according to the FCC, 21.3 million Americans don't have broadband internet access. Broadband Now has reports that the numbers are actually understated. So in areas like Mississippi, where there's a lot of rural parts to that state, they're saying that they actually believe that it's greater. They think that it's double that number. So we're talking like 40 some odd million Americans without broadband access. And so that was a startling figure. I didn't think it was that high. And then the idea of moving into this virtual world, but these people are still left behind and can't get access to this technology and innovation.
COVID has definitely increased economic stratification and made the disadvantages that afflict underrepresented groups even worse. It's not just the fact that they're working in positions that expose them to the virus more frequently. It's also that their children are unable to participate in what's rapidly becoming modern education via broadband. It's very dispiriting because we've looked at the progress that's gone on in our lifetimes and may have been heartened by the yardage that was gained. Then something like this happens and it sets everyone back, but it disproportionately sets these already afflicted communities back even further. And I wish I had some silver lining or some way to say that it could be resolved. But if you look at history and you look at the way that technology advances the interests of the already privileged, it looks like we're in for a long haul.
That's our show for today. If you enjoyed it, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. That would really help us out. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at mailbag@hitstartmedia.com. For Theo Miller, I'm Zibby Nwaka. Have a great week.